This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Robert McNamara, who is considered the architect of the war in Vietnam, died early today at the age of 93. We're going to listen back to a 1995 interview with him and an interview with Errol Morris about his movie The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert McNamara. Let me quote the New York Times McNamara obituary by Tim Weiner. Quote, Robert McNamara was perhaps the most influential defense secretary of the 20th century. He helped lead the nation into the maelstrom of Vietnam and spent the rest of his life wrestling with the war's moral consequences. Serving President John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson from 1961 to 68, McNamara oversaw hundreds of military missions, thousands of nuclear weapons, and billions of dollars in military spending and foreign arms sales. 500,000 American soldiers went to war on his watch. More than 16,000 died. 42,000 more would fall in the 7 years to come. The war in Vietnam became his personal nightmare. He concluded well before leaving the Pentagon that the war was futile, but he did not share that insight with the public until late in life. In 1995, he took a stand against his own conduct of the war, confessing in a memoir that it was wrong, terribly wrong. Unquote from Tim Weiner's obituary. Here's an excerpt of the interview I recorded with Robert McNamara when that 1995 memoir was published. In the interview, he refers to Dean Rusk, who was Secretary of State during the years McNamara was Secretary of Defense. I asked McNamara if he saw his book as an apology.
Some people have used redemption, apology. Forget redemption and apology and say that I think those of us, assuming for the minute I'm correct, as I say in the preface, I believe it was an error, a tragic error. Assume for the minute that my judgment is correct, then I think we owe an explanation to future generations of what happened and how to avoid that in the future. That's the purpose of the book.
To explain.
To explain, and more than explain, to draw lessons and suggest how to prevent similar tragedies in the future.
Do you think an apology is appropriate?
Well, if you want me to apologize, of course, but that's not the issue. The issue isn't apology. You don't I'll call it correct a wrong by apologizing. You can correct a wrong only if you understand how it occurred and you take steps to ensure it won't happen again.
Let me ask you about the anti-war movement. I think some of the conclusions that you reach in your memoir about the war, why the war was unwinnable and why it was a mistake, leaders of the peace movement were saying for many years, for example, that the communist threat wasn't as great as it was represented to be, that the North Vietnamese, even though they had a small and low-tech army, had strong nationalistic feelings and a will to keep fighting, and then that would inspire them to just keep pushing. I'm wondering if you listened to the peace movement at all, or if you shut it out and just thought, you know, they're wrong and I'm not going to pay any attention to what they're saying.
Now, I listened to the peace movement. One of the close friends of my middle child, a daughter, organized and led thousands of individuals to march on Washington, demonstrate against the president, against me. My daughter, several occasions, brought him home to dinner after that. On one occasion, after dinner, we went into the library. We talked until 10:30. As he left, his last words, very serious, were, "No man can be all bad who loves the mountains as much as you do." I listened to the protesters. I had them in my home. So that's one point. Now, the second point, you have to understand where we came from. And many of the protesters had not. President Kennedy, Dean Rusk, and I, and many others of us, had fought in World War II. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Churchill said millions of men lost their lives in that war because the West reacted too late to Hitler's menace to the security of Western Europe. And by God, says Churchill, we should never do that again. Just after that war, the Soviet Union took control of Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia. After that, in my period, in August of 1961, the Soviet Union sought to take Berlin. General, I called Norstad, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, to my office. I asked him how we would have to react. He said, you may well have to use nuclear weapons. This was a dangerous world. A year later, Khrushchev put nuclear missiles into Cuba. To this day, the American public doesn't know how close we came to nuclear war. In June of 67, the Egyptians vowed to eliminate Israel from the face of the earth. The Israelis learned of it in advance. They attacked Egypt, knocked the hell out of them, hit Jordan as well. Kosygin used the hotline for the first time, the Soviet prime minister, to Johnson, said, if you want war, you'll get it. It was a dangerous world. That was driving us to our action in Vietnam. We were wrong. The protesters turned out, with hindsight, to be right. We didn't believe it at the time.
You raise the question in your book, you know, why didn't you and other government officials spend more time on questions that seriously challenged some of the rationales of the war? And you write, readers must wonder, readers of your memoir, must wonder how presumably intelligent, experienced officials failed to address questions whose answers so deeply affected the lives of our citizens and the welfare of our nation. An orderly, rational approach was precluded by the crowding out, which resulted from the fact that Vietnam was but one of a multitude of problems we confronted.
Let me digress just a second to say I signed a contract to write an autobiography. And when I presented the book proposal to publishers, I outlined how I was going to do it, and I had a section on the Defense Department. I was there 7 years. Vietnam was just one of 100 problems, if you will, we were dealing with at that time. I didn't mention one, the Bay of Pigs, which occurred within 90 days after. It was a total debacle. Then we faced Berlin, then we faced Cuba, both of which we handled, I think, very, very wisely and very well. Then we faced the June 67 war. Again, I think we handled very well. But in between this, the cities were burning. We had racial problems. We had riots in the cities. And Vietnam fitted in all of this, and we did not organize properly to deal with it. I think we organized admirably to deal with the nuclear danger in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it was a relatively simple thing to deal with it. It was a short period of time, a simple, narrow issue. We should have organized, I'll call it a war cabinet, Churchillian war cabinet, to deal with Vietnam. We didn't. That's one of the reasons we failed to address the questions you've outlined.
But Vietnam was a place where, you know, thousands and thousands of young Americans were dying. I guess it's a kind of frightening thought that you felt you were all just too busy, and that's one of the reasons why the war went the way that it did.
No, no, you're conveying a misimpression. It was that, my God, we were working, 18 hours a day, 7 days a week.
But you were too busy to see more clearly is the point you're trying to make.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that we were overwhelmed with problems, and we hadn't organized to segregate out from those people to work solely on Vietnam at the upper echelons of the government. And that's one of the lessons. And in the last chapter, I point to 11 lessons, of which that's one. For God's sakes, Mr. America, when you face military conflict, organize to deal with it effectively.
I want to get back to the peace movement for a second and ask you if this kind of behavior had any effect on you. You write in your memoir about how, after speaking to students at the Harvard Business School, a group of students surrounded your car and were shaking it. And I mean, you were surrounded and felt quite under attack. You were at the Seattle airport after climbing Mount Rainier, and a man came up to you and spit on you and called you a murderer. You're at a restaurant, a woman comes up to you and calls you a baby killer. What impact did that have on you?
Well, I relate all that in the book to emphasize that there were protests. And I was aware of them, as I've just outlined. My children were of the generation that was protesting. One of them was at Stanford, for example, and was involved in the protests there. I know you point to the protests at Harvard.
Let me focus my question a little bit more so you understand more of what I'm getting at.
No, I understand.
But allow me to just focus it a little more. I'm wondering if that kind of direct confrontation put you in a position of hardening yourself more against the protesters, whether that behavior reached you and made you think something wrong is happening here.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was the latter. No, it didn't harden me. How could it harden me when I mentioned that my daughter brought protesters into the home, and when my son was associated with them in California? And as a matter of fact, I was meeting with one of the major protesters, a chaplain at Yale at the time, and I met with many others because I felt we had to stay in touch with them. And you haven't begun to deal with this issue of protest. Let me tell you something. It's in the book, and I hope your listeners will read it. A man, a Quaker, one of the finest human beings, his name was Morrison. He burned himself to death under my window in the Defense Department. And yesterday, now, so the first point I want to make is I was aware of the way people felt. I was aware of the problem. They didn't see the danger of Soviet communist aggression leading to the world war that Dean Rusk predicted would happen if we didn't save Vietnam. But yesterday, I received from the widow of Mr. Morrison, she's now remarried, her name is Ann Morrison Welch, a letter, and I want to read one paragraph. To heal the wounds of that war, we must forgive ourselves and each other and help the people of Vietnam to rebuild their country. I'm grateful to Robert McNamara for his courageous and honest reappraisal of the Vietnam War and his involvement in it. I hope his book will contribute to the healing process. She was a protester. He was a protester. She is a noble lady. She understands we should look back in retrospect. We should draw the lessons to try to prevent that from happening again.
I guess what I think a lot of people want to know is this. During the period when you had grave doubts about the war and 1,000 Americans a month were getting killed in that war, was it hard for you to not speak out publicly? And then also after you left the administration and the war continued for 7 more years and American casualties continued to mount up, if you had such grave doubts, how did you not manage to share them?
You misstate my position. It wasn't that I had, I'll call it, grave doubts about the war. I had grave doubts that we could win it militarily. And that is a major distinction. At the same time I had grave doubts about winning it militarily, I, along with my associates, believed that if we didn't prevent communist domination of Vietnam and use of that to obtain communist control of Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Laos, Cambodia, we would be moving to a World War III. And therefore, what I had to do was reconcile this fear that we couldn't win militarily with the fear that if we just disengaged, we'd be on the way to World War III. And the way I brought those together in these memoranda of May 67 and November 67 was to say to the president, Mr. President, I don't think we can win militarily. We've got to use our military pressure as a basis for negotiation that will permit us to disengage militarily without leaving South Vietnam to communist control and the start of World War III. That was the basis.
Let me tell you something a friend said to me when she knew I was going to interview you. She said, "Oh, I bet he wrote this book because he knows he's going to meet his maker."
Look, when I meet my maker, the book isn't, he's not going to consider the book. The book was not written for redemption. Redemption is between me and my maker, and the book will have no influence on how he responds to that.
Robert McNamara, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you indeed.
Robert McNamara recorded in 1995 after the publication of his memoir. He died today at the age of 93.